Welcome to another episode of Evidence-Based GI. We will be talking about the new ACG clinical guideline on preoperative risk assessment and management in patients with cirrhosis. I'm Leandro Sierra, one of the residents at the Cleveland Clinic, and with me is Dr. Zachary Fricker, hepatologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has played a key role in designing and implementing this guideline. Dr. Fricker has also led the development and validation of postoperative risk models in cirrhosis, including the widely used focal pain score. It is a complete honor for me to have him here. How are you, Dr. Fricker?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
That's great. So just to summarize, the guideline by ACG provides a practical framework to stratify preoperative risk in cirrhosis, providing four recommendations, a summary of multiple key points, and an extremely useful algorithm that serves as a step-by-step workflow when optimizing or advising a patient with cirrhosis before undergoing extrahepatic surgery. Although it would be impossible for us to cover the full guideline, I prepared some questions for Dr. Fricker that can give us some takeaways before reading the full manuscript. So my first question for you, Dr. Fricker, so this podcast is sometimes and multiple times heard by students and residents, and sometimes for them can be really difficult to know whether a patient has cirrhosis or not, especially when they know there is a fixed timeline before deciding if this patient is going to go or not surgery. My question for you will be, what are some challenges that you have found before doing or before making a diagnosis of cirrhosis? What is your recommendation and how can this differ in the multiple settings that we have, inpatient, outpatient, or emergency departments?
Sure. I think it's a very common question that comes up and an important one. And it does depend on the context and I think importantly on kind of the condition of the patient, the timeline in terms of the urgency of a potential surgery, and critically, how vital it is to have this information in advance. It's certainly always of interest and useful in thinking about risk stratification, but there are times when it's critically important and other times when it's probably a little bit more of a luxury. So for example, if this is a diagnosis that would serve as a contraindication entirely to the surgery, either because it was deemed unacceptably risky or because the intended surgery becomes almost irrelevant. For example, imagine a patient in need of a heart transplant who was going to be deemed ineligible in the context of cirrhosis. Then I think the urgency is high. The need for as much precision as we can have with the diagnosis is there. And probably we, in many cases, want what we consider kind of gold standard evidence. So this might be a time when a liver biopsy makes sense. These patients are often in the hospital. We need an answer urgently, and we need it with high confidence. In the clinic, we may have other options that are potentially less available. It depends on where one works. Other data points like elastography findings, for example, frequently can be challenging in the hospital or are confounded by comorbid state of the patient, but maybe more practical in the office. So I think it varies based on the context. There are times when, with a compelling clinical history, with respect to the risk of chronic liver disease and strongly suggestive findings in laboratories and imaging, we may be comfortable making a diagnosis alone based on that. So I think it has to be done on a case-by-case basis, and you have to think about it in the context of what's the goal of getting that information and how quickly do we need it.
Incredible. Yeah, that it is definitely sometimes important. It is definitely sometimes can be different. And let's say that you went through the step-by-step process and you determine that the patient does have compensated cirrhosis. Now, the next step, while reading the guideline, it mentions quite often that we need to assess for clinically significant portal hypertension. So in this workflow or in this group of idea, why do you think that is important to assess for clinically significant hypertension? And most importantly, how do you think that it would change the surgical decision-making?
So it's an important metric because it predicts or is associated with, a number of post-operative potential complications and may change decision about the proceeding with a planned surgery, modifying technique or planning. And it should be thought of in a broader context of the risk assessment for these patients including other metrics that we might use to try to assess for their risk of adverse postoperative outcomes. Clinically significant portal hypertension can be, from a practical perspective, defined in or identified in different ways. And, you know, direct measurement of portal systemic gradients is certainly a well-validated mode, but we've tried to allude to many others that may be more widely available or use information that's already available in the patient's record when possible in the guidelines as well.
Right. Yeah, it is definitely a cornerstone of the guideline and the algorithm. One of the other things that the guideline mentions and put a lot of attention in is using the vocal pain score for risk stratification, and it compares with other scores that have been used as well, like for example the MELD score and the CHALPUS score. So I would like you to tell us and to tell our audience, what do you think about, first of all, the vocal pain score? What are some of the limitations? What is the cutoff that you would recommend to tell, yes, this patient is undergoing surgery, or no, this patient cannot undergo surgery? And another thing is, how do you compare it with MELD and CHALPUS score? I've seen that a lot of experienced hepatologists still uses CHALPUS score in their practice.
Sure. These are all good questions. So all of these scores are imperfect in their own way, and they're all limited by different factors, you know, the nature of the population or experience from which they were derived, the fact that they're intrinsically kind of retrospective looking metrics, and so they don't speak to an entire cohort of patients who didn't undergo an operation, for better or worse. So they're all in some ways wanting. I think the strengths of the vocal pain score in particular are incorporation of multiple types of surgery into the derivation cohort, a diverse derivation cohort that we think is reflective of modern practice as best we can, and a, you know, a fair bit of data that validates that from centers across the country and even the world. There's no specific cutoff in terms of the output from any of these scores that should be an absolute contraindication to a surgery necessarily. And I think in general, as you know, as often, you know, consultants in these cases, our job isn't to say you should or shouldn't have a surgery necessarily, but to say this is to the best of our ability the expected outcomes or what risks we think are relevant and how likely they are to occur. And that has to be thought of when weighed against the potential benefit that a patient will get from a surgery. You know, a surgery that's a life or death operation may have to proceed, but we should at least be aware of what the stakes are. And then, so that's a sliding scale for assessment. I think all of these metrics have value, and because they're generally readily available from data we have, it's very reasonable to think about all of them, you know, together and think in context about how we can best triangulate the uncertainty of risk here and get the best sense of it we can.
Perfect. That's a great point, and that has had a really important information. It's really important to identify and to stratify the patient using tools that we have available. Yeah. Within the same framework, I've seen that multiple of the recommendations in the guideline have very low quality of evidence, or they have no enough evidence. So one of my questions was, looking at the future, what do you think that in the future we can do in order to strengthen these recommendations and pass from an expert consensus to a more evidence-based recommendations within a future guideline?
This is a tough space for some of those they're building that evidence base, because I think it's historically been something that's been mostly retrospective. So I think, you know, developing prospective studies that are focused to, you know, a particular indication for surgery or a particular intervention, and we have a limited amount of data about the role for tips in reducing perioperative risk, for example, and this is essentially retrospective data, and the selection for those patients is very particular, and so we need to know before we make a recommendation for something that's invasive like that and carries its own risk, you know, what is the degree of benefit and who are the patients who benefit? And I think we need to think about these things by reducing the amount of variables involved. So we may be thinking about, you know, a particular subtype of operations for which we're trying to assess risk or reduce risk. And then what's the particular subtype or state of patients that they're intended for? and we can identify those sort of prospectively and follow outcomes and ideally do that with enough diversity in terms of the people in the centers involved so that these are fairly generalizable, because there is a fair bit of heterogeneity in terms of practice in this space.
Incredible. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Fricker. We have had a huge expert in the topic invited to EVGI today to discuss this guideline. I would like to invite everyone that has listened to this podcast to go now and read the guideline or summary that was published last week, in which we collect everything that was important and that Dr. Fricker and his group mentioned in the new ACG guideline. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to speak on behalf of a great group of co-authors who really, I think, worked collaboratively to look at this from all angles and try to give the best recommendations we could for clinicians.
Thank you so much.